This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture with Jim Poplava and John Loeffler. You know, over the last 3 months, I'm sure you've been listening, and we've been focused pretty heavily on the Fed's rate raising cycle and then its long-term implications for the economy and for financial markets. We've also discussed the stock market rally since the election versus what the fundamentals are telling us, because the markets have been moving on the proposition of having tax cuts, infrastructure spending, which we do need to do, by the way, and deregulation. But, you know, the word that keeps coming down from the Trump administration is that these things are going to take time. And so while there was euphoria as to what could possibly be coming, at the same time, it's going to be a while before delivery occurs. So now that we know those things take time, what we're focusing on now is risk, because if things get crazy, you really need to be focused on risk. You need to understand it, recognize it when it's high, and then learn how to control it.
You know, John, this is probably going to be one of the most important shows that we're going to do this year. And one of the things that is really important to take a look at, and John, you remember when we were coming out of the Great Recession and the first couple of years following that, probably I would say to the year 2012, most of the calls that we got, most of the emails we got, everybody was expecting another crash. Well, they forgot that the crash already happened, because if you take a look at where the S&P was on 2009, when it got down to 666, it had dropped from its peak in 2007 at 1576. So the market fell, the S&P fell 58%. Now, if you take a look at now, since March of 2009, when the market bottomed to today, the stock market is up 254%. And is up over 270% if you add in dividends. So in 2009, everyone was fearful. Today, I would say at best, everybody's complacent. I mean, if you take a look at the VIX, it spiked in 2008 at 89.5. Today, with the recent little hiccups that we had, it's at 14, but got as low as 9 and 10 this year. So what we want to do is focus on risk and get you to think of risk much different than the way the markets think of risk. The academics talk about risk and they view it in terms of volatility. When the market is volatile, as it was in 2011 or let's say 2008, the VIX spikes, and that's what people call risk. And we're going to take a different view of risk. At our firm, we define risk as more of a function of price.
Before you go on, I want you to expound on that a bit, because most people, when you talk about risk, they think it's the market being in gyration, but that's not what you're referring to here.
No, I mean, when the academics and the markets define risk, they're really thinking of volatility. The fact that, you know, the stock market can go up 300 points in one day and drop 500 points the next day. I mean, we've had a couple days like that this week. On the day we're doing this show, the stock market is up 174 points. We had a couple days this week where it was down over 100 points. But risk, and here's the thing you have to understand, risk doesn't necessarily stem from weak fundamentals. It can be present without weakness in the macro environment. And I want to point out, nobody was thinking about risk. I mean, if you think back to 1999 to the year 2000, it was the new economy. It was technology. Nobody was thinking about stock market valuations or the price that investors were willing to pay to buy a share of stock. Likewise, if you go back to 2005 and 2007, when the market was getting leveraged and getting crazy, nobody was thinking about risk. So you usually don't think about risk when the economy is doing well, when the markets are hitting new records. But that's exactly the time you should be concerned about risk, just as you should be this year in 2017. So risk tends to surface more when you have a positive economic environment. That's when people are euphoric. That's when people are feeling optimistic. What we're trying to say here is risk is really more a function of price. If you take a look at what was present in 1999 and 2000, it was elevated stock prices. What was present between 2005 and 2007, it was elevated stock prices and, for the first time, very elevated real estate prices. So risk, when you think of risk, it is really a function of price. When markets get pricey, they become more risky. Likewise, they become less risky. For example, when the S&P got down to 666 in March of 2009, believe it or not, when people were most fearful, that's when there was less risk to the markets because the markets had already lost close to 60% of their value.
But you must admit, I think, here that there's usually some kind of an event that tends to trigger risk. I know you and Todd Mariano were talking about earlier that geopolitical risk became a real significant part of the landscape after 9-1-1. But there's always some kind of an event. Circumstances set up and then wham, something will trigger it and then everything rolls from there.
You know, a lot of times when you're talking about risk, people talk about probable things. But the problem is with probable things, when you're talking about probable things, they fail to happen. What you really need to worry about when you think about risk is called improbable things. The things that happen that nobody sees, or they're what Nassib Taleb talks about in his Black Swans. So we as a firm analyze risk. We find it comes primarily when you see high prices. High prices imply losses rather than potential gains. If the stock market is up 275%, people tend to extrapolate. Well, it's been going up 15% a year. It's going to go up 15% a year for the next 5-10 years. That's when you're most at risk.
Yeah, and I know in line with that, you've been pointing out here that this is the second most highly valued stock market in stock market history.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a look at the last 100 years, if you were looking at probably the most high-priced stock market, it was probably the bursting of the tech bubble in 2000. The second one was 1929, and the third was the present. Well, given the fact that the markets have moved higher, now the present market is the second most highly priced market in stock market history. Two high prices, John, usually come from investor psychology. That's too positive, and investor sentiment that is very positive. It often comes from what I call the absence or the dearth of risk aversion. Because when people are feeling positive, they're not looking at risk because things have been going on for a while that are very positive. So there's a tendency. But if you look at investment risk, it comes primarily from too high prices. And too high prices often come from excessive optimism, inadequate skepticism, and risk aversion. And this contributes to the underlying factors that can include lower returns. Obviously, if the stock market has gone up almost 300%, your ability to earn higher returns going forward are less than when the stock market was back at 666 back in 2009. The other thing that tends to lull investors into a sense of safety is consistent high returns and good performance by risky assets. And of course, strong inflows of capital and the easy availability of credit. We've had all of those. We've had the stock market up just about every single year over the last 9 years. We've had good performance in risk assets. I don't care if you're looking at emerging markets, if you're looking at small cap stocks, junk bonds, just about every asset class has been performing. And we've had strong capital inflows into the market, because where were people going to get a rate of return when you were getting zero at the bank in cash? And so these are the kind of things of what we're starting to see today. And where has capital flowed? Well, investors, individual investors, most of their capital has flown into the bond market over the last 8 years, searching yield. If you look at institutions, their capital has flown into the stock market. And there's something that we call the capital market line. And that is basically, if you took an investment course, they would talk about safe investments versus, let's say, riskier investments. And obviously, if you were in a safe investment, picture a CD, a money market fund, or let's say a treasury bill, the rate of return would be lower. And as greater risk is taken, you would expect higher rates of return. Now, historically, and this is incorporated into most financial planning software, historically, money market funds have yielded 4%. 5-year treasuries have yielded, let's say, 5%, and 6% for 10-year treasuries. High grade bonds have yielded 7%, and the historical returns from the stock market has been 10%. You start moving up the risk scale. Junk bonds have returned 12%. Small cap stocks have returned 13%. Real estate, leverage buyout, etc. So, in other words, the greater risk that you're taking on, you would expect to be compensated by a higher rate of return. The problem is that we have seen the lowest interest rates in history. So the result is the capital market line is starting from a much lower level. Another way of saying that and putting it is there is a greater amount of risk. For example, you look at, instead of historically, T-bills have returned about 3.8%. along with money market funds. Today, the return on a money market fund is 0.3%. Historically, 5-year treasury bills have returned 5%. Today, it's a little over 1.75%. Historically, 10-year treasury notes have returned a return of 6%. Today, there are less than 2.25%. High grade bonds, which have returned, let's say, a 7% return, high-grade bonds today are a little over 3%. Junk bonds, which have returned, in a warning for those of you jumping at yields in junk bond funds right now, historically, junk bonds have returned 12%. Today, the return on a junk bond is 5%. And if you take a look at, if we take the earnings yield on the S&P, it's a little over 4.6%. And it's a little over 4.5% on the Russell 2000. So the bar for each successively riskier investment has been set lower than any time in my entire investment career. The result has led to a number of things. It brings on elevated PE ratios. It narrows credit spreads. That's the difference between, let's say, high quality sovereign debt and junk bonds. It brings in undisciplined investor behavior. It increases leverage and increases demand for all asset classes.
Why don't we take each one of those things separately, if we could? Because I think the point you're trying to hammer home here is the markets are elevated. And when they get elevated, that's when there is the greatest risk. And nobody saw that. Remember back in 2000 when tech market imploded, and then in 2007 when we hit the housing credit crisis.
Why don't we begin and just start taking a look at PE ratios? I mean, if we take a look at PE ratios on the S&P on this week, it's 21.5. On the Dow, it's 18.6. On the NASDAQ, it's 26. And it's almost 22 on the Russell 2000. And if you look at some of the popular, what I call momentum stocks, the technology stocks, because technology has been the leader since this rally began after the election, Google selling at 31 times earnings, Facebook at 44, Netflix, brace yourself, 185, Amazon 183, Microsoft nearly 32, and Priceline 28. So if you look back at bear markets and recessions, what has occurred? They begin with a Fed rate raising cycle, which eventually leads to a recession, which eventually leads to a bear market in stocks. And another thing that is present at the beginning of a bear market is elevated PE multiples, very much like what you're seeing today. And we're seeing this right now with narrowing credit spreads. We've seen this as credit spreads have narrowed. That's meaning that investors are taking on more risk, but they're not getting compensated in the form of a higher rate of return. And the other thing that we're seeing is margin debt or leverage is also associated with these high risk periods. And margin debt is at record levels along with the stock market. So, what am I trying to say here? What we do know now is, one, the Fed is on a rate raising cycle. Two, economic growth is weak and anemic. Number three, asset prices are elevated. And number four, something we have not seen, the Fed is withdrawing liquidity with mentioning that going forward, they're going to be shrinking their balance sheet. And what does that imply? It implies number one, interest on the government's national debt is finally rising for the first time in 8 years. Number two, interest payments to the government is going to be reduced as the Fed shrinks its balance sheet. And number three, it's going to force the Treasury to start issuing more bonds. And it's like anything else. When there's more supply than there is demand, the price has to go down.
So then I guess, what would you say the implications of all of this are?
Well, risk to bond investors and risk to stock investors. I mean, it's really hard to believe that about this time last year, yields were set to drop to the lowest point they were in recorded human history. One third of all sovereign debt out there had negative yields. And you had examples like, for example, Switzerland issuing 30 and 40 year bonds and the government actually getting paid to borrow. In other words, if you were an investor in Swiss government bonds, you paid the government to loan them money. And the result of that is many of the most popular bond funds peaked during that period of time. And one of them was the Treasury bond, which peaked at 141 TLT. Today it's closer to 121. Now, what's elevated right now is corporate bonds because the yields are lower. What's elevated right now in addition to stocks are high yield bonds because they act as almost like a proxy for stocks. And so if there's anything that I want to stress right now, I still think the stock prices are probably going to go higher because markets usually have a spectacular blow off in the final phase as the market peaks as fewer and fewer stocks are driving the stock market. In fact, there was a great article in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about just 10 stocks alone were basically driving or accounted for over 50% of the S&P's gains this year. Apple was one of them. Apple stock being up over 22%, Facebook being up 23%, Amazon up 20%. So as you get towards the end of a peak of a market cycle, fewer and fewer stocks participate. It's the larger cap stocks with the largest market value that account for the majority of gains in the market. And it's certainly taken place in the first part of this year where we've actually seen the stock market up 4.7%, and over half of that was accounted for with a handful of stocks. Basically, 10 stocks accounted for the S&P's 5% gain.
So what you're implying here is that everywhere you're looking, whether it's the bond market, junk bonds, stocks, or the emerging markets, the prices are all elevated, and therein lies the risk. And so given that, then, what are you doing?
Well, we've been de-risking portfolios, and we began that last winter. We're raising cash. We've moved into floating rate bonds where we think it's a safe place to be. I mean, if I can get 4 to 5% in a floating rate bond, which goes up as the Fed raises interest rates, and what is the Fed telling us they're going to do? They're going to be raising interest rates. That's what we call de-risking. Because, John, they never ring the bell at the top. Who knows what the event is going to be? Is it going to be a financial crisis? Is somebody going to go belly up like what we saw happen in 2007? Is it going to be some emerging market event, something that happens overseas? I really don't know. And I don't think there's anybody out there smart enough to tell you. But we do know this. When prices get elevated, as they are today, the second most expensive market in stock market history, risk is rising. And you need to be cognizant of that and start looking at risk rather than looking at rates of return.
So the three rules that you want to remember here are, number one, understand what risk is. Number two, have the recognition when it's high. And three, take measures to control it.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
I think there are two things that you really have to keep in mind with North Korea. The first is that regime survival is going to be the most important thing for the regime in Pyongyang. Now, the thing that has changed and the thing that is probably keeping President Trump up at night is that Kim Jong-un in North Korea seems to have taken pictures or is indicating that he's moving away from a nuclear weapons program to an actual deliverable nuclear weapon. The problem that the United States sees is that it is increasingly less sure that Kim Jong-un is not just trying to get things out of negotiation and trying to get respect or money or whatever other thing, but is actually trying to build this weapon. And that's a red line across which the United States is not going to let North Korea go.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Ever since hitting bottom a year ago, February, at $26 a barrel, this is a clue here, the price of oil has doubled and stayed above that for more than a year. And the markets have been relatively complacent, trading between $45 and $55 a barrel. Now, the reason behind this somewhat, the thought behind this, is that OPEC has become a floor for oil and American shale is the ceiling. And if we look at the trading over the last year, this pretty well describes it. So why would we think that perhaps oil prices are heading higher?
You know, there's growing signs, and they're just subtle signs right now. And usually the markets usually operate on a paradigm. And the paradigm is, as you just mentioned, John, OPEC is the floor, American shale is the ceiling. And the other factor that goes in there is the crowded inventories. We're storing oil on tankers, we're storing oil in big storage bins in various places around the world. And as long as we have this big, large storage that was created as a result of the glut, you know, we don't have to worry about oil prices. But oil prices often move at the margin. And what we are now starting to see is signs that these OPEC cuts are starting to work. We're starting to see, if you take a look, not just here in the United States, because our media here in the U.S. tends to focus exclusively on inventory levels at Cushing or various storage areas in the United States. But what we're starting to see globally is oil is coming out of tankers, which is the most expensive place to store. The Caribbean island oil storage is being drawn down rapidly. And we are now starting to see the first signs that the oil markets are beginning to rebalance. And that is starting to begin and will get bigger as we go forward. And that is the thing that I think the markets aren't focusing on. We tend to focus on seasonal times of the year, like right now, when all of a sudden gasoline inventories are being built up. Why are gasoline inventories being built up right now? What's coming up here in the next 6 weeks or so is the summer driving season when vacation starts. So it is natural that you're going to see refiners start to build up gasoline stocks because there's going to be a greater demand. But we had a slight increase, which was one of the reasons oil prices sold off in the first quarter, due to we saw maximum output by OPEC in the fourth quarter. Basically, OPEC put together a deal that said beginning in January 1st, we're going to start cutting back production. Well, what did every OPEC country do before January 1st? They pushed out as much oil as they could because they knew they were going to have to restrict production. So it's basically they put everything out there that they could. The result is we saw a slight build in inventories in the first quarter. So if you want to watch what the catalyst or change is going to be going forward, watch inventory levels is going to be number one. And number two, watch that OPEC extends when they meet in May 25th, they extend the cuts going into the second half. Because if they were not to extend those production cuts or start cheating or going back on that, then it would send oil prices plunging again, because what you have right now is increasing U.S. production. And we'll get into U.S. shale production here in just a minute. But right now, there's three factors that are driving price. On the supply side, we have OPEC cuts. Number two, we have global oil demand, which is up roughly this year will be up about 1.3 million barrels a day. And number three, we have depletion. On the negative side is U.S. oil shale production is increasing. And number two, shale producers are hedging. According to a latest oil report, shale producers are anywhere from 60 to 80% hedged on their production for the year. So shale producers increased their hedging by almost 50% this year alone. The other thing that we're seeing is the rig count globally is rising. Here in the U.S., it's over 672. It's up 10 rigs in the last count, and it's up 356 rigs since it bottomed in May of last year.
But it would seem like what happened here is that OPEC realized that the intent was if they overproduced, they'd put U.S. producers out of business. But it actually backfired and they got hurt in the process of that because the U.S. is more market driven and it can adapt more readily.
Absolutely. And that's why I think when it comes to May 25th, there's a couple of reasons I think that they're going to extend those cuts into this second part of the year, because everybody knows that U.S. shale production is increasing and it'll be up by the time we get to the end of the year. Shale production will be up over 1 million barrels from the bottom. So as U.S. production increases, they know if OPEC was to go back to its old ways and not stick to those production cuts, we could be talking about $30 oil again. So that's a disaster they want to avoid. So right now, according to Bloomberg Intelligence, compliance was 104% in March and 64% from 28% for non-OPEC production. So it's interesting because this week we had two investment firms, Citibank and both Goldman Sachs, see oil surging by $10 a barrel into the mid-60s as we approach the end of the year, as these inventories begin to work off. And that's really, it's those large inventories that are out there that has really kept oil in this range and has kept oil from breaking out, because there's a lot of oil on tankers. There's a lot of oil in storage bins. So even though oil surged after the OPEC announcement, there was also the reality that OPEC production increased, and you could see that in tanker flows. We monitor, in addition to rig counts, we also monitor tanker shipments, because you want to know what OPEC's really doing? Watch what is being put on a tanker, because they're a large exporter. If they were cutting back, there would be fewer tankers leaving the Middle East. You have more tankers leaving the Middle East, that means they're pumping out more oil out the door. So OPEC, basically, prior to the production cuts, what everybody did is, if everybody knows you're going to have to go on a diet, it's kind of like a feast. They pumped out as much oil as they could in the fourth quarter. And of course, that showed up in inventories in the first quarter, where a lot of people were saying, all right, they did the cut. Where is the evidence that inventories are starting to be drawn down? They weren't, but they are now. And that's the key as we look at these oil markets.
So I guess the higher oil prices here are contingent upon OPEC extending the cuts. But if that doesn't happen, then down she goes. We're not going to see higher prices.
The reports that were coming out this week out of Goldman and Citi, that was one of the things they were talking about, is a lot of this oil that is stored at sea on these tankers moved to onshore sites. And then they cited, for example, these large storage areas in the Caribbean. Inventories that would undermine output cuts by OPEC are starting to shrink. And I think the real key here is the Saudis. And the recent Saudi minister said that they're targeting $60 oil. There's a number of reasons why the Saudis have incentives, and they're the largest producer that is cutting their production, because they plan to take Aramco public next year. It's probably going to be the most highly valued company in the world. And also, it is probably going to be the most highly valued IPO. Another thing that we're starting to see too, Chinese demand has been increasing. We're also seeing Chinese oil production fall, meaning that as their production falls, it means they have to go in the open market, import more oil, which we're starting to see. So if you want to look on the demand side, you really have to follow what's going on in Asia, because the Western countries like Europe and the U.S. are less of a factor, especially as we go to more electric cars and more alternatives. So there's a very good incentive for the Saudis to want $60 oil. But what we've seen so far is, and this is what I think the divergence that we've seen in oil stocks, everybody forgets this, But oil was one of the best performing sectors in the S&P last year. I think oil stocks like the XLE ETF were up 28%. So it's not unusual for it to see a breather and lag behind. But recently, the price of oil stocks have been lagging the price of crude. So you want to see confirmation. Just as you see, for example, now with the rise in gold, you're also seeing the gold stocks confirm the rise of gold in silver. And the other thing I think you're going to see that could change this dynamic going forward is if you look at two of the sectors that are about to deliver the most robust earnings for Q1 are oil companies. The international oil companies are set to report their highest earnings they've experienced since the first part of 2015. So if the oil forecast is right, we would expect to see a rise in interest rates, a rise in energy stocks, higher CPI, because oil translates into the economy and it causes prices to rise, and also to see the Fed get more aggressive in terms of what it talks about in terms of rate hikes or shrinking its balance sheet.
So then assuming, I guess is what we're looking at as an indicator here, assuming OPEC follows through with the oil cuts, then oil prices will rise largely as inventories are worked off.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
There's too much to fit in a weekend financial program. That's why we do a daily version of the Financial Sense News Hour, just like this weekday show.
Since World War II, debts have increased, and that's been good for us because we've been able to take that debt and put it into innovative things and create progress and growth, and everyone has been benefiting. But since then, around 2000 is actually when the long-term debt cycle started to roll over, and that's because at a certain point, you just can't keep adding more and more debt. So the debt burden becomes so large that the amount of payments it takes to service that debt is actually deflating the economy. So that turned around in around 2000. It's still going on today. These cycles are extremely long. But that's why we've seen now the opposite turn around with the recent populism. So we've had countries kind of pull back from the globalist mindset. We've had a little more instability within countries, and that's seen by a lot of these recent elections. And the U.S. is a great example of that, on top of the fact that standard of living has become a little bit worse as the long-term debt cycle has rolled over. The wealth gap within the society itself has widened, and so that creates frictions. So the fact that this debt cycle is rolling over is largely why we think societies are pushing more towards populism and isolationist ideals, is because they're going back into that scarcity mindset, not that abundancy mindset. And so that's our high level psychohistory model, if you'll call it, in terms of how we evaluate, you know, where we think the world's at and how we justify the current populist narrative. And then we can take that populist narrative and then we extrapolate that to what does that mean for markets going forward.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the big picture for this week, where we try to make some sense out of all of the data points that you are dataing every single week in the news. If there's one thing we're awash in, it is data points, but it's harder to make sense of what's happening. Speaking of making sense, last week we presented one aspect of Fed policy that no one seems to be talking about. Everybody's looking at interest rates, but it's the impact of changes in the Fed's balance sheet. And we need to do that further here on the program today, because in reality, while few people may be looking at it, this really has broad implications, much more than right now the markets would seem to be anticipating. And if they make a move on this area, as well as on raising the interest rates, this could wind up blowing up in the Fed's faces with a major policy mistake in the making. So you might want to explain, Jim, how this all works, because it's a little head scratchery for people who don't know.
Well, first of all, we haven't seen them do anything like this before. And remember, the Fed's balance sheet was roughly about $800 billion before the financial crisis. It's currently around $4.5-4.6 trillion. Now, last week we talked about what are the implications of the Fed shrinking its balance sheet. We've talked about every half a trillion dollars that they shrink in their balance sheet, it's equivalent to an increase in the federal funds rate of 1%. Now, the way it works right now, as the Fed bought these bonds when they were doing quantitative easing. These bonds pay interest. And what happens is the Fed receives this interest. They pay all the expenses of running the Fed, and then anything that's left over, they remit to Congress in the form of kind of like a dividend. And just to give you an idea how big that number is, it's been running about $100 billion a year. So Congress is counting on this. It's one of the ways that the budget deficit was reduced during the Obama years as the Fed expanded its quantitative easing program. It received more interest from the bonds that it bought, and any excess income the Fed didn't need to pay its own bills, it remitted to Congress. It's already starting to shrink. It's down to $90 billion. As the Fed shrinks its balance sheet, we could get remittances down to maybe $10, $15 billion a year from 100. So right there alone, you have one factor that's going to increase the budget deficit. The second thing that we pointed out last week, for the first time in 8 years, interest on the national debt is growing, because during the entire 8 years under Obama, every single year, the average interest rate paid on all the government's debt was going down. So even though the national debt was growing every single year by over $1 trillion, the interest on that debt was coming down. So the government actually spent less money. Now, what we pointed out last week is in the month of March alone, interest expenses up 30%. Just in a single month, it's up 22%, I think, year over year. And as the budget deficit this year is up $64 billion above last year, which was up over the year before. So what is the trend? The trend is the budget deficits are rising as a result of two things. One, more debt. Number two, there will be less remittances from the Fed. Number three, interest rates are going up. For example, the $64 billion increase in the budget deficit in the first 6 months of the government's fiscal year, which begins in October, half of that is attributed to interest or the rise in interest rates. So if you take a look at last year, we spent $430 billion in the government's fiscal year on interest, even though we had $8.6 trillion more in debt. Now interest expenses up $28 billion. So we're going back over to what we spent in 2008 when we only had $10 trillion of national debt. When the government spent $450 billion, that figure is going up and it'll be going up each year. As the Congressional Budget Office reported last Friday, the interest expense on 1% increase in the overall interest rate, and that interest rate is rising, is going to cost the government an additional $160 billion a year. You add to that the fact that the Fed is not going to be remitting as much in interest. That could be another $100 billion. So already we're talking about $250 billion increase in the national debt just from those two factors alone. Now, I want to talk about another side effect of a shrinking balance sheet that is going to affect certain indicators that point to a recession, and also how this is going to impact the bond markets with higher interest rates. I know a lot of people are saying right now, well, gosh, the interest rates have come down recently. You know, we're not worried after the Fed raised interest rates in December and March. Interest rates actually came down. Let's talk about what's going to change that. Now, in order to put this in perspective, let's talk about what normally happens when the Fed goes through a rate raising cycle. The immediate impact, obviously, is on short-term rates. And we've seen that with Treasury bill rates, which were negative last summer, are now close to 0.8% on a three-month T-bill. So as the Fed raises, its immediate impact is on short-term interest rates. They begin to rise, and there is usually a gap between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates as the cycle begins. Eventually, this changes. It's called the yield curve, meaning longer-dated treasuries pay more interest than short-term treasuries. It begins to flatten as the Fed begins to raise short-term interest rates. Now, what happens here is the market knows, as we always point out here on the program, eventually the Fed's going to raise interest rates, which is going to do two things. Most likely, it's going to slow down the economy, It's going to bring down inflation and probably end up in a recession. So eventually, as the Fed continues well into its cycle, one of the first indicators of a possible recession is a flattening of the yield curve, and then eventually an inverted yield curve, meaning that short-term interest rates are higher than long-term interest rates. And this has been a fairly accurate predictor of recessions for almost since the end of World War II. It's been one of the things that Wall Street and analysts look at to give them an indication that, hey, we're getting close to recession, especially as the hikes progress, the curve flattens and then begins to invert. Now, it's currently sort of flattening. So, you know, it's too early to say, is this a warning? Because right now, our recession indicator is at a very low level. But eventually, as they continue, as the Fed is wanting to do, with the markets anticipating June and then maybe December. Now, this regular progression is about to change for the first time since World War II. Because as the Fed reduces its balance sheet, they have account, it's the largest account on the Fed's balance sheet. Its nickname is SOMA. It's System Open Market Account. Before the financial crisis, it was $690 billion. Today, it's roughly over $4.2 trillion of roughly $1.8 trillion in mortgage-backed securities and $1 trillion in treasuries. Now, with the end of QE, the Fed hasn't been buying any additional treasuries. But what they have been doing is, as they have treasuries or they have return of principal from mortgage-backed bonds and interest, the Fed has been going in the bond market and buying mortgages, reinvesting in mortgages, reinvesting in treasuries.
Let me interrupt you there for a second as we've gone through this. Why is it generally people are not paying attention to this? Why is this? Because this is, I would say, as important as rate raises.
Well, number one, they just recently started to raise this. This really came out in the recent Fed minutes accompanying the FOMC meeting. So this is something new. You know, we haven't seen this. And so that's probably one reason. And the other is everybody's paying attention to, well, they're hoping we're going to get some form of stimulus in the way of tax cuts or in the way of fiscal spending that would offset what the Fed is doing with interest rates. And so the market has been paying attention. But notice, since the Fed raised interest rates in March, look what's happened to the stock market. We've basically been going nowhere. We've been going sideways. Now, a lot of people think that, you know, the markets could head higher. I think we could see higher prices in the market, but that's all going to be part of the topping process. So right now, there's still a lot of optimism in the market.
Yeah, and if we track all of this through, you have to ask what the other implications are, because if the Fed is not buying treasuries, they will not be remitting as much to Congress, which then increases the deficit, because the Congress has that less to work with, despite the huge commitments it's got. And then as the Fed raises interest rates, seems like a double-edged sword. Government is paying more in interest on its debts. So now, is that the limitation, or are there more implications here?
No, there's another implication here, because when the Fed stops buying treasuries, what happens is then the Treasury has to increase the size of its Treasury auctions. Let's just say that the deficit's going to be $600 billion. The government needs to raise $600 billion. But of the $600 billion, let's say the Fed has been buying a good portion of that debt. So the Treasury has to come out with less amounts of debt in its bond offerings, because the Fed is basically sopping it up as it reinvests its interest and as it reinvests the bonds that mature. Now that the Fed starts shrinking its balance sheet, it means it is no longer reinvesting its interest. It's no longer reinvesting the bonds that come due, which means the offerings that are coming from the Treasury are going to be larger. Now, what do we know about supply and demand? The more supply that comes to the market, it tends to drive down the price. And one of the reasons that you've seen interest rates so low has been because treasuries, number one, pay more than what sovereign debt pays overseas. But number two, the amount of treasury debt that has been coming to the market has shrunk as a result of quantitative easing and the Fed reinvesting. So the Fed, as it invests less money, will force the Treasury to come out with larger bond auctions, which is going to raise the supply, which is going to raise interest rates. So this curve flattening and inversion that you normally get in a Fed rate raising cycle, as the Fed raises short-term rates, the yield curve begins to flatten and eventually reverts. Well, now what you're going to have is you're going to have more supply coming into the market, meaning more bonds are hitting. They will have to price those bonds and make them more attractive, which means interest rates will have to go up. We know that, number one, deficits are going up. They're going up because Congress is spending more money. They're going to be going up because interest expense on the debt is going up. They're going to be going up because the Fed will be remitting less money to the government. I mean, it's like, I hope somebody in the Trump administration is basically talking to the president and go, you realize what the Fed's doing, what this is going to mean to the deficit at a time you want to spend more money as president. And so this normal curve flattening isn't going to be the same as we've seen in past cycles. And so the implications of all of this, John, is interest rates are heading higher.
What should investors then be doing in anticipating all of this? I guess an example would be, what are you doing?
Well, I mean, right now, we just don't see, and as we talked about in the first segment of The Big Picture, when things get crazy, don't get lazy and focus on risk. We're staying with the short end of the curve because, you know, if I own a bond that matures in 1 or 2 years, I don't care what happens to interest rates. I'm going to be pretty well protected. Secondly, if I own interest rate floating bonds, as interest rates go up, actually, we'll be receiving more interest. And I think that's going to be the safest place to be, because once again, we've never seen anything like this happen since World War II. So this grand economic monetary experiment that we've been engaged in since 2007 and forward with 0% interest rates, we are changing now, and there is no playbook. There is no rule book that the Fed is following. They're just hoping and keeping their fingers crossed they can pull this off without exploding something. So buyer beware, caveat emptor. There are vast implications of shrinking a balance sheet. We've talked about three of them now. We talked about number one. It's going to raise interest rates on the government debt. Number two, the Fed is going to be remitting less income to Congress on what it earns on its investments. And number three, it's going to force the Treasury into bringing more bonds to the market because the Fed is no longer a participant buying these treasuries. So it's going to raise interest. So there are three implications that we've seen here so far. And as an investor, you can't afford to take on these kind of risks, especially when we're looking and dealing with the lowest interest rates in recorded history, a topic we covered in BP1.
At the bottom of all of this, Jim, it seems like we're going to be following the Fed and its rate rises. But as you said, the balance sheet is also has major implications. That's something we're watching. So everything's on a watch list right now. You know, oil prices, like we discussed earlier, and the Fed. And that's what we do here on the program. And speaking of doing that, what are we watching for in the weeks to come?
I think, John, we're still going to be watching the economic numbers as we get into this month. We're going to see more of these LEIs get reported, and we're going to be following, are they increasing, implying that second quarter GDP is picking up? Normally, if we take a look at the last 8 years, the second and third quarter are the strongest quarters of the year, so we'll be watching that. And also, we're going to be watching these earnings reports as we get in full bore into earnings season in the weeks ahead. And especially, we're going to be watching, as we just talked about oil, we're going to be watching earnings by many of these oil companies, which are expected to double this year versus last year. So those are the things we're going to be watching. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.